Hello everyone, this is the Red News Fanzine Podcast. Thank you all for listening, and thank you all for buying the mag. And if you don't buy the mag, buy the mag. But if you want to support us a little bit more, we also have a Patreon that you can sign up to, and it's patreon.com/rednews. Now, here's the podcast. Goodbye.
Hello everyone. It's a special international break. Make the most of it. Have we really got another international break? Red News Podcast 281, where I talk to the actor Jim Whelan, who, if you've read the mag, please read the mag, wrote a kind article on his United and acting life for the latest mag. And now I get to talk to him, which I'm looking forward to. Jim, for 5 decades, followed his dream of becoming an actor, whilst never attaining star status in his eyes. He traces his story from 1942 in the back streets of Salford to the present day. A glorious gallop through 50 years of highlights, which include film, television and stage appearance, which we'll get onto after United. He's performed with Jeremy Brett, Ray Winston, David Morrissey, Carolina Hearn, David Tennant, Rob Lowe, Christian Bell and many more. And Coronation Street, which you'll see in the photos in the mag, featured largely in Jim's life and career. Whilst working as actor, he still is at 83, what an age, as well as working with Roy Barraclough, Barbara Knox and Kurt Bride and Peter Dudley. He's also appeared at the Oldham Repertory Theatre, and he's still working as an actor. He appeared last year in This England, which starred Sir Kenneth Branagh. Fair play. And I look forward to this chat. And quickly on to the last one, a new low, wet puns. And I think we should get Paul. I've never heard Paul that angry when talking about food pre-match. Jesus. Dunk made the point after the Sunderland game. Wasn't it nice? Isn't it nice? Just the days after a United win compared to the defeats. I think the tilt is getting bigger because of all the online noise which we create ourselves. But a point I noted, Dunk says, on Saturday was Sunderland putting a couple of players on the keeper whilst they took long throws and corners, and he pushed them away, he barged them away. He obviously wants to dominate his area, and I like that. And I need to clarify this. It's not your best or favourite player. Come on, Riaz, Remy Moses. It's who you like as a United player that others hated. And I'm going to bloody screw up the whole conversation now, because I said I'd used to love Gordon McQueen, but other people did. I just loved his gallopy runs. So just to clarify, I think everyone got a bit confused. It's not your favourite player, who you liked, Riaz, Remy Moses, we all loved. It is, who did you like that nobody else did? Paul Lintz, because it tilted, we'll have that. But we can't really include Darren Fletcher and Ander Herrera, can we? I've just asked a daft question. Anyway, and also Friday is World Mental Health Day, and you know it's important to us. So what we're going to do is release the Manchester Mind details for this December, and it's titled One More Step. I plan to release this today. Just take care of yourselves. I don't have the answers, but you all being here, us talking shit, matters. So just talk if you want, don't talk, but just please dig in. And there is help out there if you need it. And Manchester Mind is our connection with, and what the aim is one more step. I'm going to aim, daft, miss is not happy. I did 500,500 in December 2023, which is a lot for these aching bones. So I'm going to aim for 501,000 steps this December. But what I want you to do, if you can, is get involved. So aim for one more step in whatever devices you use, health apps, all that nonsense. Look at your step count for last December and beat it by one. And if you can get involved with that, if that sounds something doable, obviously we want you to do more if you can, it's just let me know by email. Let me know what your step count was last December, and then let me know what it will be this December, and we'll total them all up, and let's get a hefty amount and also beat last year's by a hefty amount. Something simple, really, but it is just to raise funds for our fundraiser, which we won't start promoting it properly till December, but we'll go live this Friday, and I'll put it out there. Anyway, not going to talk about Anfield. We're going to win there, aren't we? Leaves that in the air. Now, I'm going to go on to Jim. And here's Jim. So I'm really pleased to do this. And what I love, sorry to mention 1942 and being born, you know, some time ago, but you look fantastic, is I'm fascinated by that era and just growing up. What can you remember of Manchester back then?
Well, just about everything. I've got to say mainly Salford. Well, I was a war baby. I was born in 1942. If I carry on for two or three minutes now and give you a quick resume of how I started as an actor, and then we can come on to United. Would that be all right?
Yeah, of course it is.
Right. I was born in 1942. I was a war baby. And when we were kids growing up in the back streets of Salford, it goes without saying that everybody was skint, but we, for some reason, were skinter than everybody else. I was one of five kids born in 6 years to a first-generation immigrant Irish couple. So, obviously, we were poor, but we were poorer than everybody else. I couldn't figure this out, and when I did, it hurts me, even to this day, to say it, but it was our dad. He was feckless. He was a gambler, and when he worked, which wasn't all the time, every penny he earned went to the bookmaker. So our poor old mama had three jobs to try and keep our heads above water. We didn't care, we just got on with growing up. And as I grew up, I had a shocking inferiority complex, and I think it came from this background, because at the time, just after the war, being Irish was no fun. You know, it was a hard time down at the bottom. And so I always thought I was no good and that I would never get anywhere. And then when I was 13, I joined our local youth club, and that changed my life, because it was run by a sergeant major kind of character. And he brooks no argument, but I loved it, because we played football in the winter, cricket in the summer. They had a badminton court where I learned to play badminton, and I'm still playing now after a fashion snooker table. Halls where you could, rooms where you could sit down, have a cup of tea for a penny. And it was always packed because it was very well run. But he was a hard man, a sergeant major. And as I went in one night at 7 o'clock, he said to me, "Whelan, I want you to be in my one act play. Please be at my office 8 o'clock. So Jack said that, you did it. So I turned up at his office at 8 o'clock. And my heart gave a little skip, because there were five other 13-year-olds there, and three of them were girls. Whee! Because I'd just discovered girls at that time. Don't worry, they hadn't discovered me. And so we went in, and he gave us our tiny little scripts. It was only a 25-minute play, and he said, OK, we shall read the script. And we started reading it. And he let us get about 10 seconds in, and he banged his book down on the desk. He said, "No. That is dreadful. This is what you will do. I will tell you how to say each line. I'll tell you how to respond when the other people's talking. I'll tell you where to walk and where to stand. You will do as I say." And we did that for an hour. And when we'd finished, he said, "Thank you very much. We're going to do that every week for the next 3 months." And we did. And after 3 months, he'd entered us in a competition for all the amateur junior section societies in the whole of the Manchester area. There were dozens of them. And we entered this competition, and we won it by a country mile. But we had no idea why. We weren't actors. We were just robots doing exactly what Jack had told us to do. And a few years later, when I said to him, "Jack, when you put us on stage that time, do you think you were being a bit harsh?" And he said, "Well, yeah, maybe you're right." But the thing was, I had no idea how to get six urchins from the back streets to have any idea of theatre or drama. And in my case, he was right. It worked. Because from that day onwards, all I wanted to do was act. But not for the reasons you think, not to become rich or famous, just as well. But I had this terrible inferiority complex. I wouldn't talk to people. I would blush if I ever spoke to them. But suddenly, on this rickety stage in a converted Nissan hut in front of an audience of about 45 people, I was confidently walking around saying the lines, and I had this excitement in the pit of my stomach, and I couldn't figure out why for years. And then I realised, and it's still the same now, that isn't me up there. I am hiding behind the character. I'm being the character. And this excitement is adrenaline, and I think I'm still chasing it, even at my age. So then I carried on in amateur theatre. When I left the youth club, I joined Salford Players Amateur Theatre Group. lovely people, 200-seater theatre. I did everything, helped to build the scenes, played small parts and everything. One thing did drive me mad. For the first year I was there, they couldn't stop talking about this boy who'd been there the year before. And his name was Krishna Banji. I'd never met him. And it was Krishna Banji this, Krishna Banji that. And a fella came in one day and said, "Hey, Krishna Banji's gone off to drama school in London, and he's changed his name." And someone said, "What's he changed it to?" He said, "Ben Kingsley." In 1959, Ben Kingsley was a boy at Salford Players. And that's how it continued. 10 years later, a much bigger society, that was the progression in those days. And you have to remember, you won't know, you're too young, but there were very few television sets about. And amateur theatre had a great hold on the population, and they used to fill their halls because people were starved of entertainment. So I joined a bigger club. I was playing a leading role eventually in one of their plays, and I finally persuaded an agent to come and see me. And this lady came to see me. Her name was Zena Sharp. She said, "All right, I'll come and see you, darling. You're very lucky. Corner me in the bar." I cornered her in the bar later, and her exact words were, "Well, you do have a modicum of talent. I'll take you on my books as soon as you get your equity card." Well, you couldn't appear on television in those days at all without being a member of Equity. And you couldn't get an equity card without having some professional work on your sheet, none of which I had. But then someone told me, if you were a pub or working men's club singer, didn't matter where you worked, if someone paid you and gave you a letter to that effect, you qualified. So I went out to auditions and I sang, and for 3 months I was terrible. And then eventually I managed to control my nerves, and a man gave me a booking, and I said, "Will you give me a letter to say?" And he said yes, and he took it down to Equity, and they gave me a provisional card which lasted 6 months. And with that provisional card, you had to get at least 3 jobs to be made a full member. Piece of cake. Yeah. Once you're here, yeah, what I'll tell you in the next minute. I took my brand new card to Zena Sharp. She took me on and she interviewed me, and she said, "Now, darling, have you ever appeared on television?" She knew. I said, "No." She said, "Have you ever been in a studio?" I said, "No." She said, "Right, you will have to start as a background artiste." Posh name for extra. So an extra I became. My first programme was Family War. I went down there, I was so excited. I went to makeup, they cut my hair short back and sides. I went to wardrobe, they gave me a soldier's uniform. A props man gave me a rifle, no bullets, and I was third soldier on the left. I never saw it, so I don't know what happened. But for the next 5 years, I was an extra, and I worked on every single programme, because at the time, extras were in great demand because of the equity regulations. Maggie stopped them 10 years later. So I went on to, from Family at War to a thing called Sam, The Stars Look Down, A Passage to India, I'll Be a Market when it started. We went to Leeds to the brand new studios of Yorkshire Telly, just got the franchise, and I appeared in a new farming soap that was on at 1:30 in the afternoon called Emmerdale Farm. Over the years, I stayed at Yorkshire on Heartbeat, The Royal, and many more. We went to Liverpool for the Live of Birds and for things like Brookside when it started, and then back over to Manchester for Coronation Street. And after 5 years, Zena phoned me and said, "Darling, I have an audition. You have a part for Coronation Street. If you get it, you will no longer be an extra." Now, this is how important my part was. It was 4 lines, man in corner shop. No character name. So I went down, there were 6 other extras there, but I got the job. And I did the part. And from then on, I was a small part player. It took me 5.5 years plus all the other years. And as a small part player, I've earned my living for 40 years and so on. So that's how I started.
It's incredible. You know, like for a great believer in karma and twists of fate, that you going there as a young age changes your life, you know, and there will be other people in similar situations who didn't, you know, like, it's just crazy how life can, one little path and decision can lead to something that's taken you here, you know. It's quite, I always get deep, you know, like how little quirks, how one decision can offset, can make such an impact. What do you remember of Salford as growing up?
I remember as being homely, friendly. None of us had any money, and this is how I started going to the Cliff, which was United's training ground. We used to play out all day, and we played football from morning till night. We had no money. Nobody had any money. You never had any cash. And somebody said, why don't we go down and watch Salford at the Cliff? And somebody said, well, how much is it to get in? He said, I think it's threatened. He said, well, we've got no money. He said, I'll show you how to get in. And we walked down, and we went down the fence at the back of the Cliff. It's the Irwell runs alongside the Cliff training ground. And we went down the bank and held on to the wire fence and went round it and inside, thinking we'd done something really rotten. If anyone catches us, they were injured. Nobody took a blind bit of notice. And there were maybe 100 people in. And I'm sure if we'd have gone to the gate, they might have let us in anyway, because it was so free. So that I started watching there, Salford and United A team. And we didn't really know who they were, but we used to watch them and think, crikey, they're all good, aren't they? They were the cream of the cream.
Yeah.
You know? And it led on from there until when I was 14, I first went to Old Trafford. But the thing you say about little things changing people's lives, yes, you're quite right. My feelings that I was never any good for anything and I would never amount to anything led to me never having a proper job or a career or something. I left school. I started on the docks as an office boy. After 4 years, I left. I was a red-coated butler. I just was footloose and fancy-free. And the way things have evolved, I've ended up with a 50-year career, if you want to put it that way, as a small part actor. And during that 50 years, I've worked with some of the top people in the business, but it's all by sheer chance. I never planned any of it. It's just the way it happened. English actors like, and when I think back to it, I think, oh, I was lucky then, but I didn't think so at the time. Jeremy Brett, Ray Winston, who helped me an awful lot, David Morrissey, David Tennant, Sarah Parrish, Samantha Bond, Francesca Annis, and the genius that was Carolina Hearn. I was in, I think, the best ever episode of The Royal Family, the one where Nana died. And that has just evolved over the years. And the older I get, hence the quote at the beginning of my piece in your magazine,
yeah,
saying the older one gets, the more importance people attach to things from long ago. And so at the time, a lot of people are fascinated by the fact, first of all, that I've lived this long, and secondly, that I can remember it. But that's just the way it happened, pure dumb luck and just carrying on, you know.
But I think you do, you know, like, because from what I can gather and people I know, that if you're a nice person, you get, you know, offered, and if you're known as someone who's not nice, then that lingers in the air as well. So I think that's testament to your personality. And as this is, you know, United, we have to with joy get on to the period that you started going. So describe again, like a fascination, describe that first visit.
Well, I was 14 and I was working as a delivery boy for a grocer's. And they used to exploit me. I had to work all day Saturday, and when I wasn't delivering, they'd have me weighing out bags of sugar. You've got a great big sack, and you'd have to weigh out £1 and £2. And they'd have a barrel of butter, and it used to open with all the splays down the side. And I had to measure the whole lot into, weigh it into £1 and £0.5, wrap them up bags. And I got sick of this, so I used to hide. I'd disappear into the back, and I'd grab one of the assistants, Daily Mirror. It was always the Daily Mirror, and I'd read it. And on the back, I could always see this Busby and Babes. And I thought, what does it mean? Babes can't play football and things like that. So I said to my cousin Mike, same age, same football team at the youth club. And so I said, shall we go and see? And he said, why not? So we got the number 70 bus, which drops you at the docks we walked over the Trafford Road Bridge and through all those giant warehouses till we got to the ground. And then we went in the first junior gate we saw, and I think I said it was about half a crown, two and six. You know, I think it was about half that. I think it was only about 1 and 3 to get in. We just paid and we went in, and we stood there and we watched. And it was like a glorious awakening for both of us. We didn't know what we were expecting. I can't remember the result there, but that was it. I was done. We went to every game that season and every one afterwards. And I watched until I got married in 1975. And I gave up my season ticket then, because I had a season ticket for about 5 years from 70 to 75. Because I worked with an ex-babe who'd been transferred just before Munich. I can tell you later about him. Mm. But I watched from that day onwards. And when I was 15, I started work on the docks. And that's when Munich happened.
I don't want to pry, because you say it's, you know, you've written in the mag, it's not something, you know, like, I don't want to make you upset. And but the players, you know, like watching them play.
It certainly was a different time. Footballers would earn 2, maybe 2.5 times what we earned, which was, you know, a lot of people earn more than footballers. They only got better. But if you think back to when you were at school, or when we were, there was always one good kid in the school better than anyone else. And we had a couple like that, and they went on to play for the town team. But they never came anywhere near being on United's books, yeah, or becoming a professional footballer. So they were so good, but they were our friends. And I can't describe to you, to anyone who never saw him, people think it's hyperbole what Duncan Edwards was like. But he was a colossus. He wasn't necessarily big. He just could do anything. And when he was playing, anyone who got in trouble, give the ball to Duncan. They would give it to Duncan, and he'd get us out of trouble. It was amazing. When Bobby Charlton first came into the team, I was quite upset, because he took the place of Billy Whelan. And I used to tell people that Billy Whelan was my cousin from Dublin. He wasn't. But I didn't like the fact that Charlton had taken his place. And they were like our friends. Eddie Coleman was from a little street in Salford, round the corner from where we lived. So I felt a much greater kinship with them. Might have been our age, maybe it was just because I was a kid. But I read this morning in your magazine about a chap, and he's talking about tickets going for £135 to include a voucher to get a meat pie and a drink of Bovril or something. I can't see that, and it's taken a lot of the magic away. I've no problem talking about Munich. It sticks out like it was yesterday. But I won't talk to anyone who, I won't say mocks it. Nobody ever mocks it in my experience. But if nobody's interested, then I'm not going to say, oh, I was there, you know, and I did. But I was an office boy. I was 15 years old. I worked at Manchester Liners on the docks. I used to do all the dog's body stuff, making tea for everybody. This particular afternoon, I just made tea for all these fellas in the main office. And someone came in, I did write this, I know, and said, hey, United have had to abort the takeoff, apparently, in Munich. But they're all okay, so there's no problem. We all thought, oh, thank goodness for that. It became obvious as the afternoon wore on, and I know the time was just after 3 o'clock, but people came in from 3, half past 3, 4 o'clock. Everybody's dead. Something's happened. The plane exploded when it landed, and so on. I had to go out for the papers. It was one of my jobs. And when I went out, the headlines were the same as when the king died. You know, it was just an amazing thing. And we were all stunned. I think stunned is the only reaction I can say. We didn't cry at the time that I know of. We just got on and lived with it. And the following Wednesday, we were playing Sheffield Wednesday. And I got permission from our chief clerk in the office, please, please, can I go early? Let me go at 4:30. And I ran and ran and ran up to the ground. And I got in at the last turnstile I could see, which was at the Stretford end, which wasn't my end at all. I was a scoreboard end. There were no paddocks at the time. You could walk right round the ground. And we played, and as the team came out, it was the most emotional I've ever known of any team anywhere. Because Billy Foulkes had been in the crash, Harry Gregg had, they both played. Shea Branner made his debut on the wing and scored a couple. And Sheffield Wednesday were blown away. They had Albert Quicksall at the time, by sheer emotion. And that's how it went on. So apart from all that, I have a theory that that is one of the things, in my opinion, that made United a world-known entity. And I think that did help. You wouldn't ask for it in a second, and maybe they would have been as big. But I think that is another reason why conquering them and losing a full team, because as well as the eight that died footballers, there were another six or five or four who never played again. Jackie Blanchflower, Johnny Berry, people like that never played again. So the ripples for it were just enormous. And it, of course, it makes me emotional now and again, especially because Duncan Edwards didn't die in the crash. He died because of it, but he didn't die for 2 weeks. And we thought he'd be all right, Duncan. And then somebody said, oh, if he comes round, he'll never play again because he'll have one leg short and the other. And I thought to myself, well, what difference does that make if you're playing football? So all these silly things go through your mind as a kid. But obviously, I can never forget it. But I've had many more highs and lows over the years.
Well, you detail, you know, just sometimes you didn't, from 57 when you did the Manchester Liners work, that you would just, you'd just go to the ground for the atmosphere, or was it just to feel part of it, or, you know, on non-match days?
Not just on match days. I was so near it that if I was at a loose end, I could walk up there in 10, 15 minutes, have a walk around. I just love to be in there. And I would go to the reserve games and things like that. And I did say about, I went up there once and they were playing. They were having a kick around on the cinder pitch behind the scoreboard end. And Tommy Taylor was there. I mean, knockabout with lads who happened to be around. And I'm not sure if Duncan Edwards was, certainly I think Jackie Blanchflower was, you know, and people like, so I got some autographs and I just come and I thought no more about it, because in those days they were more accessible to us as people than now.
Yeah, they were just lads.
They got more money than not.
Yeah, they were just lads.
When I'd been going about 6 months as an extra, my agent phoned and said, darling, called everyone darling, she said, I've had a request from the Davenport Theatre in Stockport, a big theatre. Mike and Bernie Winters are in panto there, and they would like a dresser for a month. And I said, I don't want to be a bloody dresser. What do I want to be a dresser for? She said, well, why don't you just go and meet them? I thought, well, I'll go meet them then. They're big stars, which they were at the time. Yeah. Have you heard of them?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
They weren't particularly liked by a lot of people, but they were big names. So I went along and they charmed me. I wasn't used to it. Hello, Jim. Would you like to come and help us out for a month? I'd be very happy. Oh, I thought, it made me feel like $1 million, so I did it. And when I'd been, I was like being a second-hand star. All of a sudden, people would come to the door and they'd send me out. And I'd say, I'm sorry, they can't see, you know, or yes, if you could come back later. So I was very important. My importance knew no bounds, I'm telling you. And one day, a man came in and knocked on the door. And Bernie said to him, I respect him, Michael, let him in if it's him. I opened the door, it was Mike Summerby.
Right.
And he had his 3-year-old daughter with him. They'd been to the afternoon show and they came to say hello, and they knew him that, so they were talking and all that. And his little girl was driving him mad, saying, Daddy, Daddy, where's the horse? And she said, she's going mad about this bloody horse. And I said, shall I take her to see the horse? A bit pantomime. He said, if you don't mind. So I took her down the stairs to where all the dancing girls were there. And the horse was there lying, obviously, the costume on its side. And they took over the girls and they showed her where they were. And after about 20 minutes, I took her back up. And he said, oh, thanks very much. I'm very grateful. So when I finished the month, Mike and Bernie said, would you like to come as our road manager? And I thought, I'll give it a whirl. Yeah. So I was their road manager for a year. And during this time, whenever we stayed in London, I stayed with their dad in a flat in Highbury because he talked to me and I used to take him to the shows and everything, and it was all nice. And one night we had nothing to do and City were playing Arsenal. So I said to their dad, Mudgee, I said, I'm going to see the game, see what. So I was walking to Highbury and I was walking past to get to, I think it's the North End, the cheap pass, when I heard a voice from the main entrance shout, Jim, Jim! And a lot of people looked around and it was Mike Summerby. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going in the North End, because I did say we went to one or the other every week. He said, there you are. And he pulled a ticket out of his pocket. He said, that's right next to the director's box. That's for taking my daughter round and showing me the horse. And this was like 9 months later. So I went and I watched Arsenal playing City. I think it was 1-1, and Arsenal's goal was scored by Ian Yor. Do you remember?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, he came to United later. So I travelled with them all over the place. And when I'd finished it with them and I was doing my own thing, I became a croupier and I was a big star in my own right again. I earned plenty of money in the early days being a croupier. So I was a man around town. I was out getting every night. And the cabaret club was my domain. And I walked in one night and I was friendly with the compere. And one night Pat Creran came in with two of his mates. And he was quiet and everything. And he sat down and he was having a drink. And I said to Jerry Harris, was the compere, he was a Cockney boy. And I said, oh, Jerry, I'd love to meet him. Next thing I saw was Pat Creran went waving me over. Jerry had told him, so I went over and I sat with him, and he was an absolute gentleman, and he was asking me about bits of television, doing all this, and I was talking about football. And I said, you know something, Pat, I'd love to go and see backstage at Old Trafford. I only meant I'd like to see it, like see the dressing yeah. room when no one was there. You could do it now on a tour, but you couldn't then. And he said, well, all right, you're coming to the game on Wednesday. We were playing Middlesbrough in, might have been the League Cup or F. I said, yeah, of course I am. He pulled out a card with his name on and he signed it on the back. And he said, give that to the commissioner and he'll let you in and go to the player's lounge. So I went with Jerry, all dressed up, you know, and we went in, and I came out after the match and I showed it to him, terrible game, and we walked into the player's lounge. And I thought, well, I better not go mad here, you know, and I said to the lady behind the bar, she said, what are you having? I said, two Bacardis and Cokes, please, you know, I have to go a bit top shelf. And I pulled some money out to pay, she said, you don't pay, sir. So it was all free drinks. We didn't go mad or anything, but I'm just making a point.
Yeah.
And then the players came in, including Pat, who said hello. And that was the highlight of my career. I loved every minute of it. And Wilf McGuinness was manager. And something very telling happened. And I think maybe only I saw it. But George Best came in with his hair wet and went up for a drink. Soft drink, by the way. Whether he just didn't drink at the club or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
He had a soft drink. And McGuinness came up, put his arm around him and whispered, and he shook him off. He did that. As if say, oh, son of you. And maybe it was only me who noticed that. Anyway, McGuinness went shortly, and we all know what happened to George eventually.
Yeah.
He was a lovely fella. But through them and through Pat, a man phoned one day when I was a croupier and said, will you come and work at my little club? He had a club in Altrincham, and his name was Johnny Doherty.
Yeah.
Now, Doherty. If you look in it, you will find his name. He was a babe and he won a championship medal. In those days, I think you had to have a dozen games, and he had a dozen in 56 or 57. And he used to bring his medal in to show us when we wanted. And he got me a season ticket because I tried to get a season ticket, but you can't get them for love nor money. And I had plenty of money. I was a big time Charlie on the croupier. He said, I'll ask Noel Campbell. Noel Campbell was skipper at the time and they'd just won the cup in 63. That must have been obviously. So he got me a season ticket and I had a season ticket for the next 7, 8, 9 years in the then new stand.
Yeah.
Right centre and halfway up. And Noel Campbell came out with two tickets, one for me, one for Johnny Doherty's brother Ernie. And he said, they are paid. We paid normal price. There was no scalping or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I... And So I went all that time, and the season I remember most is when we got relegated, because the next season we won every flipping game.
Yeah. You
know, and it was great to be back.
Who's your hero? Or who stands out looking back?
I've got to say Duncan Edwards, but I always stuck up for people like Bobby Charlton. I don't think at times he got the respect he deserved. And when I had a season ticket, there was a man 5 or 6 seats away who wouldn't leave him alone. What were you, Charlton? Charlton, what are you doing? And I had an argument with him in the end, so it led to bad feelings. I thought Charlton was just always there. And people like Billy Foulkes. I mean, I love George Best a bit, but Billy Foulkes was our Iron Man. He'd been in the crash, he was quiet, he never said boo to goose, but he was always there, and nobody took the mickey out of Billy, you know. They didn't try to mess about with him, he was always there. So I admired that kind of thing. I remember very well George Best's debut at Old Trafford on the left wing, and those gang of lads were going home, and I said, he'll never make it. I said, he'll never make it. He's too bloody small. He'll get kicked about, and that'll be the end of him. What a judge.
But you also, mentioned that, like, you took cabbie in roles, you know, like to in between jobs, and that you'd hang around the cliff, and Fergie used to see you.
Yeah. Always in between jobs. I had to do something that enabled me to take time off. Straight away to go for an audition or whatever. So I could never, if I'd have ever had a proper job and been a teacher or worked in a bank or something, I would never be an actor, because I can't take a week off to go and do Coronation Street and come back to the job.
Yeah.
Tackle driving, you could do what you wanted. So I used to have to start at 4 a.m. and there's a reason for that. Everybody was taxi driving at the time, and you used to sit around and make no money. But if you were willing to start at 4 a.m, you have 3 hours when the night drivers had gone home and the day drivers hadn't started, and there was no traffic and you could run around. But it was a nightmare. And if you haven't scraped the frost off your windscreen at 3:30 in the morning, you haven't lived. But I did it, and so on. And what were we saying here? Just tell me again, I've got
so carried away. The cliffs, so Fergie.
So when I was driving around at 4 o'clock, as it was getting light, I was parked up near the cliff in Salford, and the site manager would open the gate and so on, and he saw me a few days, and I'll have a chat and all that. I said, you know, I can't hear the radio very well here, I'll have to try. He said, why don't you try the car park? It's very clear, which it was. And I went in there and I was trying the radio from the office. I said, hey, it's great there. He said, hey, come in then, you're all right. So whenever I was free, I would go and sit there. And sometimes I'd wait half an hour in between jobs. Fergie would come in always at 7:50. And I was never there when any of the players were there. By then, rush hour had arrived and we were busy. But at 6:30, 7:15, Fergie would come. And he'd go to his office, but he'd always say hello to everybody, including me. After a while, all right, son, hey, all right, Jim. And off he'd go, and I'd think, that's me. He knows who I am. He didn't, but he was nobody at the ground. The sweeper up, the cleaners who came out, nobody had a bad word for him, because he was very good with all of them. I didn't agree with all of his mind games and hatred, but I went along with it because it was my team and he was my manager and it was United, you know. And this one day when the site manager said, you can't come tomorrow, we're closed after this, we're all going to Carrington. And off they went, and I got my book signed from Alex, he wasn't a sir at the time. And yes, so I used to sit there and saw them many a time, and it just gave me a kind of connection with it, you know.
Jim, obviously United runs concurrently with your life, you know, like, so something of such magnitude, how do you look back and, like, feel about it?
I am more excited and more nervous now, with good reason, to watch United. I won't tell you how I watch them, but I watch all the Saturday programmes at 3 o'clock. I do all that. Because I will not, under any circumstances, give a penny to Murdoch and his cronies or any of them. Mm. I'd rather listen on the radio or even wait and do it. So I watched them and I'm frightened to death watching them. That was better on Saturday. That was much, much better. And we were in the lead. But before then, we'd beaten a 10-man Chelsea because the game was over by half-time. I know when Casemiro got sent off, it was disgraceful. But there's always theatre there, and I'm even more nervous now than when I used to be in the old days. I don't know why it should be more important. You'd think I'd got over it. When I was younger and when I lived in Manchester, I always thought that when I was a pensioner, I'd buy a pensioner's season ticket, half price, and I'd go to all the games. But then it's changed so much now that in the Ferguson days, I was often offered a ticket for, say, Everton on a Wednesday. And I wouldn't go. I think I'll sod that because it's a gimme. And yes, it would be 3-0 and that's the end of it. So in a way, I was less excited then. I'm just as excited now and I love it when I see the new stadium. I probably won't see it, but if it ever comes to pass like that, it'll be wonderful if it's done properly. I said in my piece that I never, ever liked any of the owners.
Mm.
None of them.
A dodgy butcher.
He was Louis Edwards.
Yeah.
And he was there, and he was a mate of Matt Busby, and they went to the Cromford Club and so on. He was a very big Catholic. I'm a Catholic. And it was a kind of a mafia in those days. He became chairman. It might have been after Munich, because obviously there was such an upheaval. He stayed there for the years and years and years. His son took over, Martin Edwards, and whilst I do think he had the good of the team at heart, nonetheless, he would have sold to Robert Maxwell. Mm. He would have sold in a trice. He would have, if Michael Knighton could have got the 10 million quid together, he'd have been the owner. Never mind juggling round about the Stretford end, he would have been the owner if he could have got the money together. Because he would have sold. 2, 3, 5 years later, he sold Edwards, Martin Edwards, and his share was something like £115 million to the Coomore people, as I understand it. So, for doing the wrong thing, because Knighton couldn't get the money, he made himself £100 million. So the rest is history. He can retire and do what he wants. So I've never liked the owners as such. The Coomores kept their own. And I think Ferguson has something to answer for there with Rock of Gibraltar and so on.
Yeah.
Because and then, that was kind of the start of where it went wrong.
Well, that's where we've been fighting, obviously, the Glazers for 20 years. Where I will disagree with you, Jim, for once, is about the ground. So, like, for someone who, obviously, your first encounter with it was, you know, 70 years ago, that would you have not rather have seen Old Trafford brought up to scratch, or is the new ground, you know, like for the next generations? How do you see that then?
I do think it's for the next generation, but I've always understood that it could never be brought up to the standard required because of the railway round the side. And there might be more technology which could get it, get over that hurdle. But I always thought that was the problem, and therefore that's why the old main stand, as they called it, never really was extended.
Yeah.
But I don't like the tent thing.
Yeah, no, that was ridiculous. Sometimes the sellers take the mick out of me because I have my Man U moment. But the other day I was just thinking of a 3-0 in the 80s. Does your mind get transported back to the days when you'd see the Babes? Do you think of, like, do you just smile to yourself about thinking about a certain match or something?
Very much so. And obviously the one after Munich on the Wednesday was one of them. But Busby actually came out and said, check it somewhere, I'm certain this is true, said something like, a lot of times I just hope the opposition can score first, because then they will extend us, because we were that. And we were, of course we were entitled. I was 14, 15 year old and never seen them lose. I always went to Old Trafford, you know. And as I said in the piece, When I first went away, it was the Blackburn Rovers. And when United came out, they all started booing us. They're cheeky, and people are booing. How dare they, you know? And it was a salutary experience. I've been at Main Road when Harry Gregg had not long been with United, and Bert Trautman was his. The game finished 2-2. There were 82,000 there, and I was one of them on the kickbacks. I must have been 16 because I was still at Manchester Liners. Bert Trautman gave the most expert masterclass of goalkeeping you've ever seen. And while Harry Gregg didn't throw one in, he wasn't in the same class on that day. So they're the kind of things that stick out in my mind. You know, Bert Trautman overcame a lot of hurdles and was a wonderful...
Yeah, what a story that is.
Yeah.
And Harry's, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just incredible. I've been reading from this week about Harry and just what an absolute hero, you know, just incredible. Obviously, your autobiography's Imposter and is available via Amazon. I can't thank you enough for doing this. I've got a couple more questions. Obviously, Coronation Street has been a major... concurrent in your life, you know, that we've got the photos in the mag. How's that look? How do you look back on that experience playing different roles?
Oh, with great pleasure and a little bit of I had some not so nice times there as well, but they were well outweighed by the lovely, glorious times. I was the vicar there marrying Steve and Karen, and at the time, it was the biggest storyline in the country. And I got a message through John Thompson a few months later from Sir Ann Jones saying, tell Jim that episode was watched by 17 million people. It was the biggest non-sport programme of the year. Now, I was a bundle of nerves when I started that. And I had a nice little scene with Steve and Karen where... Tracy had come in and said Steve was the father of her baby, which he was, and Karen got her shoes off and started threatening to bash people, and the poor old vicar, that was me, was trying to calm them, please be calm, you know, shut up you, you know, and this was going on, and this went on for ages. When I turned up to do my first scene, I thought, I'll do a bit of vicaring first and get my feet under the table, then I won't be so nervous. And my good friend Peter Shaw, the floor manager, said, all right, Jim, he said, we're going to get this little scene with you and Stephen Karen in the can straight away. And I thought, oh, shit, I haven't learned that properly yet. So I said, yeah, fine, Peter. And I got the script out, I learned, and we went on to do it, and the director said, well, just have a quick rehearsal, which they did for the cameras and that, and we did, and I fluffed it. And I said, oh, sorry. Okay, don't worry, it's on the rate, we'll go again. Now, time is important. We went again, and I fluffed it again. And now I was crapping myself. I didn't know what to do, where to hide. We did it again, and this time, Karen made a mess of her lines, and she said, oh, flipping heck. She didn't say flipping. She said, I don't know how I keep this job. I can never know. We did it again, and Steve did it. And that calmed me down. And we did the scene, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I realised they had done that on purpose. Because they could see that I was in trouble, and they did it. And I've always been grateful. They denied it, but I know what happened, and I've always been grateful. Those kind of things stick in my mind.
Yeah.
Sorry, mate.
No, what advice would you give to someone wanting to do what you did?
It is more difficult now than it ever was. And if you want to try and go to drama school, it was never a possibility for me, never. But it never occurred to anyone in my family to do anything more than go to school, get to work. To try to go to drama school, and my daughter tried, is very difficult. And you will come out, if you get into one of the drama schools in London, like RADA and so on, you will come out with £100,000 debt, and Jesus. Your parents will have to pay £20,000 or £30,000 per year in fees and help for the kids. So it's now gone back to being a middle class pursuit with one or two differences. People can get into soaps still from being local, but it happened a lot more at the time. Coronation Street, people would come from Oldham Theatre Workshop as kids, and they might still be in there. Steve and his brother came in, and Steve is still there, and so on.
Yeah.
So I think it's more difficult. I think we're full of with Benedict Cumberbatch, and he's a great actor, not
yeah.
But his family were well traced and he was fine. And
yeah.
Also, there's a lot of family bits in it. Saying there's anything inherently wrong, but it's skewed towards the middle classes. All I would say to someone is follow your dream and just get on with it.
You don't know what?
I'm not at all sure I've done the right thing over the years. By doing that, I was lucky to meet Helen, who was a teacher and so on. But things were difficult because I never knew where the next penny was coming from.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always went day to day.
What's next for you?
We're going away on a cruise for our 50th wedding anniversary.
Many congrats.
Next time. But since I've been down here, I'm in Eastbourne and I love it. Came down to see about grandparent duties. But do you know something, Barney? Whenever I'm fed up and down in the dumps, I think back to myself. My mother worked her fingers to the bone and she didn't get anything for her pains. And I'm sorry we didn't help her more all those years ago. And I just think if she knew that her grandson, our son Andrew, is now not just a doctor, but he's a hospital consultant. How did that happen?
Yeah.
From me not even having a job and being a very good piss artist in the back streets of Salford, Andrew, with his own family, is a hospital consultant, and Lucy is the drama teacher down here near Eastbourne. That's where we're here. So I am very, very lucky, and I don't take any credit for it, except I kept going. But I kept going because I had no bloody job. Not because I would. If I'd have had a job and I could retire at 65, that's fine. I'm still doing auditions. I'm still doing self-tapes and sending them off. I now have a London agent because the agent I was with in Manchester gave up, and the London one said, well, I'll take you on, which is unheard of. I said, well, why do you want an 83-year-old man? He said, well, you can be a COVID patient or someone. Everything I've been up for lately, I've been dead within 3 days of doing it.
We've got to do another one of these someday. Like, it's a brilliant story, and I do maintain, for better and worse, the tributaries that we all go through in every family, and that's why we're releasing this on World Mental Health Day. You know, like, things work out for one way or another for a reason, and that. And finally, you know, like, the unitedness. When someone approaches you and says, what does Manchester United mean to you?
To me, it's always been there, and it's always been a part of me, and I will never, ever change. And in the middle of last season, and especially after Bilbao, yeah. When you came back with the Lurgy,
oh.
I've never felt so down. But I always had a mantra during all the bad years when Liverpool were winning everything, and I used to keep saying to myself, it doesn't pay the rent. If they win every game, it don't pay the rent, you know.
Yeah.
Paying the rent was my main worry. It's always there, and it will never change now. And I'll be 84 next birthday. I won't see any more games live. I can't. And my brother, who went, when I spoke to him 4 months ago, I said, I would like to see one. He said, you won't see anything, because if you manage to get a ticket, it'll be up in the gods. And you're miles away. He said, I went. I couldn't see them. I had to keep asking my sons, who's that? You know, so...
Well, let's see if we can sort that out. That would be a lovely thing to do, Jim. But as I say, Jim Whelan, it's a fantastic story, and it's still many more tales to be told. And we'll have you on again if that's all right. And many congratulations on your wedding anniversary. And have a lovely cruise, Jim. And I can't thank you enough for giving up your time here.
No problem.
And we could talk all day, which is lovely. Thank you, Jim.
No problem at all. Lovely to speak to you. Anytime, darling.
Take care of yourselves, everyone listening, all right? Thank you very much, and thanks very much to Jim Whelan. Says Autobiography's Imposter on Amazon, and the story is incredible. Get the mag and read some of it as well that we didn't cover. Cheers, everyone. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome, mate.
That's